Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what are the polls really telling us in the 2016 presidential election? Two political scientists analyze. But first, the roots of the ultra-conservative media movement. With us is Nicole Hemmer. She is Assistant Professor of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center and the author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. Welcome, Nicole Hemmer. It's great to have you here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great. It's a fantastic book. And even in your preface, I was struck by the similarity of your experience with your father and my experience with my father.
Interesting.
Those political conversations and him being influenced by this sort of very extreme right talk show hosts. Tell us what happened with your dad.
So I was home in the summer of 2004, which was in the middle of a pretty hot presidential election between George W. Bush, who was running for re-election, and John Kerry, the Democrat. And I was in the car one day with my dad, and he turned to me and he said, "My project for this visit is to get you to vote for George W. Bush." And he didn't launch into an argument or into a debate or into any sort of discussion. He reached over and he turned on the radio. And we started listening to Rush Limbaugh and then to Sean Hannity. And, you know, it didn't change my vote. But it did make me very interested in why he thought that listening to those programs would change my politics. And that's what got me so interested in conservative media.
Now, did he ever change his perspective, or did he continue to listen to those same pundits and talk show hosts and stay on the conservative path?
Oh, he did. He stayed conservative the rest of his life. He listened to a lot of conservative media. It was the basis for a lot of our political debates. I will say he wasn't, you know, I think some people have this image of folks who listen to conservative media as just being sponges who absorb it all and then sort of wring it out when they're in political conversations. My dad engaged it, I thought, in a different way from that. He understood when somebody like Rush Limbaugh was being over the top. He would dismiss some of the arguments that he didn't agree with. He would sort of modify other ones when it was sort of what he agreed with and sort of not. So there was a real engagement there. I don't know that that's true for everyone who listens to talk radio, but it was definitely true for him and in my debates with him.
The findings of media effects experiments find that this is generally true. They don't take it automatically. People do pick and choose what agrees with them and what doesn't. But the framing matters. So let's move into the history that you looked at here, and particularly this connection between the far right, the media enterprises, and the campaigns. When you started to do your history, you found that this traced all the way back into earlier, much earlier times than Rush Limbaugh. How far back did it go?
Well, it really goes back into the 1940s and the 1950s. The birth of conservative media that I look at, it kind of starts in the 1940s, but it really gets underway in the 1950s, especially because folks on the right were very disappointed, in fact, suspicious of the fact that a conservative senator, Robert Taft, didn't win the Republican nomination in 1952. They felt that the Republican convention in 1952 had been rigged and that the nomination had been stolen from this conservative candidate. And part of what is fueling their media enterprises is their sense that they had sort of a right to rule, and it was being denied them by the parties, by the media. And so they went out to start their own media enterprises in order to change the political culture in the United States in order to grab power. Now, they very quickly moved from just doing media to being political organizers. By 1956, folks in conservative media like Clarence Mannion, who was a radio broadcaster, like Bill Buckley, who was the founder of National Review, were engaged in formal electoral politics. Clarence Mannion was the campaign manager for a third-party ticket that ran in 1956 against Eisenhower from a conservative perspective. So that tie with electoral politics was there right from the beginning.
There are three names that you mentioned early on. Clarence Mannion was one of them, but there were also two others, William Rusher and Henry Regnery. Am I saying that correctly?
That's right. Yes, these are the main characters of the book. I wanted to explore sort of the wide world of conservative media, not just broadcasting. So Mannion was a broadcaster. Henry Regnery had a publishing house, so he was publishing conservative books at a time when pretty much no one else was doing it. And Bill Rusher was the publisher of National Review, which was a weekly news magazine that would become fortnightly a little later on. And these were men who had been involved in politics, who were Ivy League graduates, who were well-connected, who had been involved in all sorts of sort of elite institutions, who in the 1940s and 50s start media enterprises, start these media careers that they have, because they believe that you have to control the means of communication. You have to control ideas if you're going to affect real political change. And so I follow these men over the course of the 40s and 50s and 60s as they work to build these institutions and to change American politics.
Now, one of them had been moderately left but moved away. What happened?
Mm-hmm. So Bill Rusher, when he was at Princeton, where he got his undergraduate degree, he had been essentially a moderate Republican. He argued, in fact, in his senior thesis that there should be a more progressive Republican Party, that that was how the Republican Party was going to compete with the New Deal Democrats, who by the time that Rusher was writing this thesis in the 1940s had already had a pretty strong hold on power, both in the Congress and the presidency. And so Rusher was interested not necessarily in conservatism, but in Republican political power. It's not until the late 1940s and the 1950s when he becomes deeply concerned, maybe even obsessed, with communism and the way that communism is potentially influencing U.S. politics, that he becomes a more committed conservative. And when that happens, and when he sees the election of Eisenhower, and when he sees Eisenhower go after the Red Hunter, Joe McCarthy, that's when he says, well, the Republican Party is not a party of ideas. It's involved in the same kind of compromises and the same kind of idea-free politics that the Democratic Party is, and I don't want anything to do with that. I want to wage the battle of ideas. And then he moves from being involved with the Republican Party to being more of an independent and being a conservative activist.
One of the things particularly fascinating in your book had to do with how far back certain ideas have gone. And one of the key ones was the idea that the media, the traditional media, the mainstream media, was liberally biased. How far back does that idea go, and how did it benefit them then?
So it goes back to, I would say, again, the 1940s and 1950s. And the reason it goes back to that point and not back further is that in order for you to make the charge that the media are biased, first, there has to be the expectation that media should be unbiased. And that was actually a relatively new development in American history. In the 19th century, America, like many countries in Europe today, had a partisan press where political parties often sponsored newspapers. There wasn't any expectation of objectivity. It's really not until the 1930s and 40s and 50s that you get the expectation of objective journalism in the United States. And you don't just get the expectation, but it's tied to a bigger idea of what America is and what its values are. This idea, particularly after World War II, that the United States had defeated fascism, it had defeated totalitarianism, it was in this battle against communism, and the special genius of the American system was that it was non-ideological, that it was run by experts and people who were not driven by their emotions, but were driven by their intellects. And media were part of that. This idea that journalism should be objective was this idea that it should be professional, it should be expert, and it should be unemotional. And it's in that atmosphere that conservatives begin to accuse journalists of being biased toward liberalism. And as used to as we are of hearing that charge, at the time, it was a shocking thing to say because it didn't just go to the heart of objectivity in journalism, but it went to the heart of the thing that made America different, that it wasn't ideological. And so over the course of the decades, conservatives nurture this idea of liberal bias. They say objectivity isn't actually objectivity. It's just a mask that is draped over this bias to disguise it. And because all media are actually biased toward liberalism, we need a counterbalance to that. We need a conservative media to balance out that liberal media. And so it was the justification for the media enterprises that they had started. And so you see them having a real vested interest in spreading that idea of liberal bias. For the first 10 or 15 years, it's very much just in conservative circles. But by the time Richard Nixon becomes president in 1969, it becomes one of the keystones of his politics, his charge that the media are biased against him and that the media are biased toward liberalism and leftism. And so it gets a real power as it becomes part of the national conversation in the late 1960s.
And you noted in that chapter that not only did they attack the idea of objectivity and intellect, but they replaced it with what you called ideological integrity, this sort of a legitimacy by ideology. Explain that for us.
That's right. So I think that one of the more complicated ideas that I try to follow through here is what I would say is an epistemological question, a question of how we know things are true or untrue. And for a long time in the United States, the way that we knew that things were true or untrue were these Enlightenment ideas of factuality. If you could verify it in reality, then you could demonstrate that it was true. And so this idea of factuality and neutrality were really important to figuring out what was true and what was false. What you see coming out of conservative media is instead this idea that things are true when they have ideological integrity, that they are true when they conform to the assumptions of the ideology. So if something fits in with conservative ideas, then it is true. And if it doesn't, then it is worth challenging. And so that's a big shift to measure the value of a news source based on how well it conforms to your ideas about the world. And that's something that really spreads within conservatism as the dependence on conservative media grows into the 80s and 90s and 20-aughts. So it has a small effect in the 1950s and 1960s, but in the 1950s and 60s, there just aren't that many conservative media outlets to consume. There's no way to really construct your entire media diet around conservative media. That changes by the time you get to the 1990s and the 20-aughts, at a point at which you can only read media or only consume media that conform to your beliefs about the world and don't necessarily need to conform with feedback from reality. And that's something that we've seen affecting our politics in the last 5 or 10 years or so.
The other really important finding in your book related to how they cultivated image, this idea of being outsiders, as being oppressed, but it was really a group of elites who claimed populism. How does that work?
This I found really interesting because the populist language was there from the start with the American right, this idea that we were outsiders, that we were being excluded from power by big institutional forces and by special interests, but that really conservatives were the voice of the people that were being excluded. But again, as you just pointed out, these were elites. These were Ivy League graduates. These were well-heeled lawyers. These were folks who had been appointed to the highest levels of government. So they had access to traditional sources of economic, political, and social power. But the issue was they felt entitled to all sorts of power. They felt entitled to run a political party. They felt entitled to the presidency, and they felt entitled to control of the culture. And when they didn't have those things, they thought that that exclusion must be because something in the system had been rigged, that there was some way that they were being excluded from what was rightfully theirs. And so you have this combination of entitlement and exclusion that feed this very powerful form of populism that would continue to be part of the conservative identity through up through today. That even in times like the 1980s and the 1990s, in the early 2000s, when conservatives control the presidency, the Congress, the Supreme Court, you still have that outsider identity. And that outsider identity is important because otherwise it's just elites ruling things as opposed to speaking for the people. And I think that's been one of the most powerful and effective things that conservatism has done in the United States in the 20th century is to claim to be the voice of the people at a time, especially in the early years, where it really was just a small group of elites.
Now, how do you fit the muckraking of the time and the yellow journalism of the time into this dynamic?
So you see in the early parts of the 20th century, journalism sort of developing on two different tracks. You have this idea of objectivity that I was talking about earlier, but you also have this idea of muckraking, that journalism shouldn't be neutral, that it should be emotional and impassioned, and it should be advocacy journalism. It should be fighting for something. So you see this when you see journalists going out and investigating meatpacking industry or investigating asylums, that not only are they investigating these things to find out what's happening, but in order to suggest certain policies. And in those early years of muckraking, those policies almost always involved more government involvement, that we needed more government oversight of consumer goods, more government oversight of institutions. Conservative media really does fit into that tradition of muckraking because it has both that emotional core, it has that advocacy side, and it has that driver of political change, right? The end goal is to change politics in the United States. So even though it doesn't have a shared lineage in terms of whether it falls on the right or left of American politics, it does have that shared sort of sense of what journalism is for. And so even today, we see this in sort of the gonzo journalism of someone like James O'Keefe, who does these undercover videos in order to what he believes is expose the corruption within liberalism. It's in many ways the kind of muckraking journalism we were seeing in the early 20th century. It's just trying to achieve a different end.
How did the media link with other actors to make it a movement?
So this is the most interesting thing for me is when I first started this project, I didn't necessarily think of media as a form of activism. Or if it were a form of activism, it was just a form of activism in spreading ideas. But what I found in the conservatives that I studied was that their media activism, their media presence, marked them as leaders for conservatives who didn't really have any sort of organization to join, who had a lot of confusion about politics and the two parties that didn't seem to represent them. And so what you see happening is that their audiences, their listeners and their readers were getting in touch with people like Clarence Mannion and like Bill Rusher and saying, look, you've got us stirred up with all of these ideas, but what are we supposed to do? And they turned to these media voices in order to actually do something, to found organizations, to get them involved in electoral politics. And so you see someone like Clarence Mannion going off and pushing for the nomination of Barry Goldwater in 1960. So he organizes Americans for Goldwater in order to try to win Barry Goldwater, who's very conservative, to win him the nomination in 1960. And in order to do that, he falls back on his ideas about media as the path to political change. He has Goldwater write a book of conservative belief called The Conscience of a Conservative, which really transforms Goldwater as a senator into the face of conservatism in the United States. And while Goldwater doesn't win the nomination in 1960, he wins it in 1964. So you have that political activism. You also have someone like Bill Buckley, who, again, is the founder of National Review, going off and founding the organization Young Americans for Freedom in order for there to be an organization for college students and young people to join in order to learn about conservative politics and become political activists. And that central role that these media folk play actually turn them into leaders of a movement rather than simply just messengers, rather than simply just voices on the radio or writers in magazines.
Now, how do groups like the Birch Society, the John Birch Society, and those types of organizations fit in with this?
So the John Birch Society was founded in 1958, and it was this very anti-communist group that was super secretive. The idea was that it was a secret society that was going to help weed out communism in the United States. They assumed that about 60% of the United States had already been taken over by communists in order to help America win the Cold War. The Birch Society went largely overlooked for the first few years, but in 1961, journalists sort of discover the Birch Society, and it both amuses and concerns them. It amuses them because they find a conspiratorial core, this idea that you shouldn't put fluoride in the water or that there are communists hiding under every bed. But on the other hand, it is this secret society that they worry could be a source of real radicalism and unrest in the United States, that they could be opening a widening war within the U.S. because they perceive everyone up to Dwight Eisenhower, the president, as a communist. And so there's this concern that the John Birch Society represents a radical right that could spread violence and unrest in the United States. The reason that that matters is that even though the Birch Society was a small organization, probably 50 to 100,000 people, it was used to kind of tar the rest of the conservative movement as crackpot conspiracists rather than actual, you know, mainstream political activists.
Now, some of the pieces that they published, such as The Merchants of Death, would probably appeal not just to highly conservative people, because this exposed some aspects of the military-industrial complex, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's interesting how much, especially in the 1930s and 40s, the early conservative movement would have appealed to folks on the left just as much as on the right, because they are taking on the major institutions of the day. There's a strong pacifist story in the origins of conservative media. If we're talking about sort of start dates for modern conservative media, it really comes out of the America First movement. And the America First movement, which was the movement to oppose U.S. entry into World War II, it's often been caricatured as isolationist or having ties to the far right, being perhaps fascistic. But it actually drew from a wide range of people, including socialists on the left and progressives like Robert La Follette, and then from right-wingers as well. It shows how politics could cut across left-right divisions. So you have a pacifistic thread that would appeal, I think, to folks on the left in the 1930s, but also later in the late 1960s and 70s. There's something about that anti-establishment idea that runs through conservatism that isn't just limited to the right.
I wonder, when the Fairness Doctrine came in, if it had some effect to move this type of media back out to the margins, and then when it came back, it allowed them back in. Do you have a sense of that?
Well, so the Fairness Doctrine, which is a regulation on radio that requires both controversial issues to be covered and to be covered fairly, my sense of the way that the effect that it had in the period between the late 1950s until it was repealed in 1987 was that it had a chilling effect on voices on the margins. And that actually included conservatives. So conservatives were seen as controversial because they wanted things like a more militaristic approach to the Cold War. They wanted to repeal Social Security, these ideas that just weren't in the mainstream of either party. But it also had a chilling effect on the left as well, on socialists, on some labor union broadcasts. So it had this way of defining the legitimate parameters of debate and then kind of chilling the folks on the fringes of that. When it was repealed, it gets repealed in 1987, right before Rush Limbaugh goes national in 1988. So there is a connection between removing the Fairness Doctrine and the creation of a more powerful national conservative media on radio. That said, I mean, it wasn't just the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine. There were a number of technological things that had to change. There were a number of political things that had to change in order to get audiences of the size that Rush Limbaugh got. So it was a number of different changes, but the Fairness Doctrine was certainly a piece of it.
So now that you've done this sort of deep history, what can you draw from that that helps inform what's going on in American politics right now today?
So I think that there are two big things coming out of this that help us understand better the current politics of today. One of them is the polarization in American society isn't just a political polarization, but it is an ideas and sort of sources polarization. That there has been over the past 10 to 15 years the development of a conservative media ecosystem that is entirely contained. So it now is possible for part of the American public to have its own facts and to operate from those. And that actually has a political effect. It eliminates any sort of common ground, common language, common understanding in order to have a politics built on shared values, shared ideas, even just shared facts. And we see that in the breakdown of the American political system, the obstructionism, the unprecedented nature of the 2016 campaign. So I think that that is a big part of it as well. The other major thing that I think it helps us understand is right now we have a major party candidate in Donald Trump who is being advised by a conservative media figure, Steve Bannon of Breitbart News. And as someone who has studied conservative media, it seems to me that we're entering a new period in conservative media where we're actually moving away from strictly conservative media to more right-wing media. So Breitbart is a site that doesn't define as conservative. It defines as populist nationalist. And just as Trump has disrupted the conservative hold on the Republican Party, so Breitbart has disrupted the conservative hold on right-wing media. It is now more populist. It is more fragmented. And I think that those changes in media and changes in politics are closely related. It's not a coincidence that conservative media and the conservative hold on the Republican Party are breaking apart at the same time.
I imagine because of the financial element that side tends to have a lot more money. And with the internet, there's also a lot more power behind these groups.
I think that's right. Although what's interesting about it is that, you know, the most profitable parts of conservative media are Fox News, Rush Limbaugh, and Sean Hannity on radio, these more formal institutions that have been around a lot longer. And those have actually become the conservative media establishment that folks like Breitbart are taking on. And these websites, they haven't tended to have a ton of money. I think that's beginning to change. But they've been able to have a major effect without as much funding because the internet allows them to do their media activism without much of a buy-in cost. It costs a lot of money to start a television network. It costs a lot of money to build a national radio program. It doesn't cost very much to host a website, and their costs grow over time, but it's just not nearly as expensive. And so more people can get in and more ideas can be sort of fostered in those environments. And I think that's part of this fragmentation story.
Well, Nicole Hemmer, author of Messengers of the Right, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thanks so much for having me.
Nicole Hemmer is Assistant Professor of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center and the author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. When we come back, what are the factors that ultimately determine our next president?
Stay tuned.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How accurate are the polls? Who will vote and who won't? What election laws affect who votes? And what will ultimately determine the presidential race? With us are two experts. Dan Lely is professor of political science at American University. She is co-author of Who Votes Now? Demographics, Issues, Inequality, and Turnout in the United States, Strength in Numbers, the Political Mobilization of Racial and Ethnic Minorities, and Mass Media and Politics, a Social Science Perspective. Jonathan Nagler is professor of politics at New York University. He is the director of the Politics Data Center and co-PI of the NYU Social Media and Political Participation Lab. He is co-author of Who Votes Now? Demographics, Issues, Inequality, and Turnout in the United States. So welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Jan Lely. It's great to have you back, and welcome, Jonathan Nagler. It's great to have you with us. So here we are, a couple of days away from the presidential election. And there's some confusing information, I think, out there in the public sphere that needs a little clarity. And I wanted to start with trying to understand what is going on with the polls. We know there are national polls. We know there are state polls. Some say our electoral system, because of the way that it is with the Electoral College, we should only pay attention to state polls. Other people say the state polls follow the national polls. What do we need to know to understand what's going on with the United States presidential election? Jan Lely, what do we need to know?
Well, the state polls are key and critical to this. The president is not elected based on a national vote. The president is elected based on their ability to win a majority of votes in the right combination of states. So the state polls give us more information in terms of trying to predict what that outcome might be or what the possibilities are. The national polls reflect the national electorate, and the president, in some senses, is the only elected official responsible to the national electorate. So they might provide some general sense of what's happening in the country, but if we're more focused on trying to understand that outcome, it's the state polls that are really valuable.
Jonathan Nagler, what would you add?
In the modern world, it's the states that matter, but luckily we don't actually have to look at individual polls per se, because the world has changed and now we have a lot of poll aggregators out there in the United States. So typically people in the United States are turning into 538.com or Huffington Post. Their pollster is aggregating the polls, and Real Clear Politics aggregates the polls. And what they all do is try to predict the probability that one candidate will win, and that's based on an aggregation of the state polls as well as just a simulation of what could possibly happen. So at the end of the day, the election is about the states. But the problem with looking at individual polls is individual polls will bounce around. And so, you know, depending on whether you're an optimist or a pessimist, you could cherry pick and find a poll that makes it look like your candidate is moving up or moving down. And it's a lot safer to look at the aggregators that are taking into account as many polls as they possibly can per state, adding them all up and trying to figure out what that might imply for who's likely to win. And even if you do that, the aggregators will differ in their predictions, but that's because they're giving different weights to the latest polls versus how much they think is the electorate is really locked in based on all the earlier polls.
Now, historically, there have been times when the polls have been wrong. And some of that is, of course, sampling error. Pollsters may not even be sampling the right people in some cases. Other times, you know, they can't reach people. Sometimes people lie to pollsters. How can we know if any of that is going on today? Jan Lely?
Well, I think it's certainly the case it's going on today. And that's one of the reasons, as Jonathan suggests, that people are trying to be careful and precise in understanding the state of play is looking at those aggregators. Because even in the best case scenario, a public opinion poll is based on a sample, which means incomplete information, and how those pollsters choose the sample, the efforts they put into getting response rates, who they consider likely voters, for example. All of those decisions, there's no particularly correct or incorrect way to do that. It requires judgment. And so I think what is lost, and I've been observing this election season as well, is we have so many polls, and it's cheap information for the media to report, and they report a polling result, the point estimates of the percentage favoring one candidate versus another, and they'll note the margin of error down in fine print, and yet the words and the interpretation they give to many of those polls suggests that 3-point spread or 4-point spread means something substantial. And I think they're doing a disservice in terms of the coverage of the polls, that no professional pollster would necessarily buy into.
Jonathan Nagler.
I think in terms of where the polls might be off here, and clearly they might be off, they can be off for a few reasons. And one is simply that the voters change their mind between the time that they talk to the pollster and the time when they go to vote. The other big problem is, and one that the pollsters have the biggest trouble with, is they don't know who's going to vote. Typically, pollsters will either use just reported history for someone, or they'll just ask the person, are you likely to vote? And both those things might be wrong. It may well be that we don't know exactly who's going to vote in this electorate. And if you ask 10 political operatives or 10 political scientists, you're going to get different answers to that. A lot of people seem to think that some of the Bernie voters will stay home. I don't think that's at all going to be true. I think the Bernie voters will show up. Other people think that Trump is mobilizing working-class white voters, and other people think that Republicans could conceivably be cross-pressured and might not show up. So we don't know exactly how that's going to happen. We can talk about that, and Professor Leakley and I can speak to who we each think is going to vote. But it's the biggest problem for the pollsters. They don't know exactly who is going to vote. And so the sample they're giving you and the population that they're trying to match, that might not be the population that votes in this election.
Now, I know the two of you have done studies on voter turnout, and I think the last study that you did was probably a decade or more ago about who votes and who doesn't. Let's look at those results first, and then how you might think they've changed. Jan Lely, do you want to start on that?
Yes, it wasn't quite that long ago. Our data went through 2008, though, which might be what you're thinking about. So for presidential elections between 1972 and 2008, we focused primarily on the demographic characteristics of who voted. And the most, I think, consistent and dramatic pattern we found related to differences in turnout of individuals based on income, that high-income individuals are far more likely to vote than low-income individuals. We also observed older individuals more likely to vote, and in terms of race and ethnicity, African Americans more likely to vote than whites, once you control for changes in or account for differences in income and education and other characteristics, and Latinos substantially less likely to vote. So these demographic findings make this election especially interesting given the youth profile of the Bernie voters or supporters and the enhanced, perhaps increased turnout of Latinos and questions about whether African Americans will continue their higher levels of turnout without Obama on the ticket. But those were the demographic findings that we focused on. We also looked at what policies the candidates stood for and the effects of election laws. And election laws matter for estimating turnout. And the thing that we think is most interesting and valuable and like to underscore is that when candidates offer different policy proposals, different views of the political future and what their candidacy represents, that's when voters are more likely to go to the polls, when they see those differences.
You know, what's fascinating about that in this particular election, and I study media more than the other phenomena right now, is that if you look across even the most elite media, there is hardly a conversation about policies. The only policies we heard were some of them during the debate, and most of it is who's being investigated, who has made another racist slur, and I have hardly heard distinctions between the two on policy. What do you think's going on, Jan Lely?
You know, Jonathan and I have actually talked about this a bit. I think there's nothing new about that in some senses, about how the media and how reporters define what news is, their need to attract audiences, the desire to have drama and conflict, the need to have new, fresh news every day and to attract an audience. So much of what we're seeing, I think, is a reflection of that, certainly reflecting Trump's unique and unusual candidacy in terms of the things he's said and done and how he's run his campaign. But the question is, voters may be seeing differences between the candidates. To what extent does that reflect some understanding at even a most basic or abstract level of the different types of policies that the candidates will pursue? And, you know, that's where these daily tracking polls just can't get at that kind of question.
So there are a couple of things in there that I want to back up and discuss. One of them has to do with what you were saying about what's going to happen with the coalitions, so to speak, of voters. So Donald Trump, some arguments that he's bringing out a sizable set of voters, maybe new, but they're predominantly from a ethnically white male demographic, it sounds like, whereas Hillary Clinton's demographic is more of the coalition, multiple different ethnicities, different genders, more on the female gender side. But as you noted, we don't know if African Americans are going to turn out in as strong of numbers. There have been some reports about that. What will happen with Latino voters? Will they be concerned? How can we get a sense of which of these predictions might be actually happening now? Jonathan Nagler, what do you think about this?
I think we've got strong priors here that Hispanics will vote in larger numbers this year for the reasons that Professor Leakley mentioned, that they're the ones who are likely to see big differences in policies between Clinton and Trump. I mean, Clinton has espoused pretty standard Democratic policies in immigration, and Trump has just come out with the most severe or extreme policy in immigration of any Republican in a long, long time. And so in terms of seeing policy differences, even though the media are not talking about those differences on a daily basis, I think most Hispanic voters in the U.S. are well aware of those differences. And so I think we've got some expectation that Hispanics are going to vote in larger numbers than usual. The same thing for young people who tend to be the Bernie supporters. They're well aware of the differences between Trump and Clinton on issues of immigration, not just in terms of Latinos, but also Muslims. And we know that young people in the U.S. tend to be much more tolerant than older people and are therefore much likely to be very much less supportive of Trump's policies. So we have a lot of reasons to think those people are going to vote. If you're asking, do we know what's happening now? No, we don't. We're going to have to wait until Tuesday. You know, you can sort of look at the early voting returns and see that whether, you know, is early turnout among blacks high or low in North Carolina. You can look at that right now, but so much of that is a product of campaign strategy in terms of whether or not they're trying to mobilize voters early or not. How much effort are they putting into that? And so it's just very hard to tell from the early returns exactly what's happening. If you see the black turnout, you know, early voting among blacks is low this year compared to 2012, that doesn't necessarily mean that overall black turnout is going to be lower. It may simply mean that many of them have decided they're not going to vote early this year. So I think trying to read the tea leaves from exactly where the early turnout is coming from is a dangrous game. And
you brought up another point that I think is an important question, which is how much do campaigns matter?
I think they can matter a lot here because, A, we know that they matter in terms of mobilization. So a lot of, you know, how people vote and getting people to polls early, that is campaigns working to drive that. But also in the absence of the media providing, you know, daily coverage to remind people, here are the issue positions, here are the issue positions, then it's left to the candidates and the campaigns to do that. It's left to the campaigns to tell the voters and remind them, here are the differences between us on the issues. And Clinton has, you know, mixed her ads between here are the differences between us on the issues and just simply, well, Donald Trump is essentially a horrible human being. And those are two very different things, trying to tell people that Trump is a horrible human being versus he has different issue positions than Clinton does.
And so the other factor that both of you have seemed to look at has to do with communication networks. How do communication networks matter, Jan Lely?
Some of what happens with the polling evidence that we have is we think of individuals respond to the pollsters' questions individually and in the privacy of their own homes or automobiles or wherever they might be reached. And I think part of what happens in the election process is through the media, but then in our social networks and the individuals we live with or that we work with, or, you know, observing yard signs or bumper stickers or buttons or whatever, you know, seeing things maybe on Facebook or in the social media, stories or reports or claims by one campaign or the other. That gives us, and we've typically found that individuals kind of moderate to those views. They can use the views of those around them to check what they are believing in terms of what is true, what's important, should they reconsider new information, who's the source, how does that fit into what they and the people around them who they might have some trust or respect for believe or look at the world. So that, I think, helps to maybe lead to individuals not bouncing around in their preferences as much as what these daily tracking polls often suggest. There aren't a whole lot of people out there going Democratic, Republican, Democratic, back and forth on a daily basis. You know, it's a smaller selection, and people, I think, are more prone to stick with their prior decision, in part because it's typically supported by their social networks or communication networks.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the factors that will influence who is the next president of the United States. I thought one of your findings that was quite interesting in your study was that some groups of people are much more insular. They don't go outside of their own social networks in terms of policy preferences, in terms of race and ethnicity, whereas others might interact more with people who have different views and different ethnicities, but have less access to, say, what you called, I think, expert information. What are the implications of this?
An example of this, frankly, is in thinking about the Latino vote this election, where, as Professor Nagler and I have reported, Latino voter turnout has lagged behind where we expected it to be and where many would like it to be, and lower than other racial and ethnic groups. And I think one of the things the strong and dramatic and even negative statements that Donald Trump has made in this campaign is it's brought a level of visibility to issues of race and ethnicity and the issue of immigration, which is of great personal importance to Latinos. And in that respect, expecting this higher level of turnout of Latinos, I think, is a reflection of that message being conveyed at such a high level and drawing individuals into the presidential election. So they may disagree with the positions taken, but yet be mobilized by the fact that that's position that's being offered in the presidential election. So individuals can be drawn into politics, and sometimes it's by those who threaten or oppose the individual's interests or preferences.
So could be fear that brings them out in some of these cases, whereas in some other groups it could be anger bringing them out. So emotions probably play a pretty big role here.
Social scientists often frame it in terms of group threat, that individuals identify as certain either in terms of gender or race or ethnicity, that they are part of one group, and others who threaten that group can be viewed as individuals they have to be less supportive of, that they have to defend their interests from, and that could mobilize in some senses. And so I think that's part of what we're seeing with Latinos.
Jonathan Nagler, you looked at social media also, and particularly with political behavior. What did you find with social media and political behavior? What can we learn from that?
So, I mean, I've worked with my colleagues here at NYU in our social media and political participation lab, and what we've found is that people actually learn a surprising amount on social media that's not just from people like them. It's absolutely true that most of the people that individuals connect with on social media are similar to themselves, but a decent number of them aren't. And it's through this almost incidental contact that they actually do get exposed to different messages And so people do have the opportunity to learn things on social media that they might not otherwise find out. And so that creates the potential for learning about different positions of candidates, for learning about all sorts of things about candidates. And we found that they then share that with people that they talk to off social media. People learn things on social media and then go talk to their, you know, their more real-world physical contact friends. So social media becomes a vast medium both for individuals to speak to each other and share information, as well, of course, as a medium for the campaigns, again, to try to mobilize their supporters and try to use their supporters to mobilize other supporters.
Did you find that on social media people were similarly insular in certain groups and others being a little bit more diverse? Like, I think this was Jan's study or a little bit earlier.
That's a really good question. We actually have not yet identified whether different groups in terms of different ethnic groups or different demographic groups are more or less varied in the types of people that they associate with. But I think that's an interesting area to look at in the future.
And so in the final analysis of this, who votes is really what will determine the outcome of an election. It's a kind of a numbers game. Who stays home, who votes, who mobilizes, that type of a thing. And Jan Lely, you mentioned earlier on about election laws. There's been quite a bit of talk about voter suppression and some of these other factors. What do we know in terms of the kinds of laws that enable people to vote easier, the kinds of laws that keep people home?
Professor Nagler and I found in Who Votes Now is really the key importance of Election Day registration as being what we think is likely the strongest political reform that states could take in terms of increasing voter turnout. It reduces registration and casting a ballot to one stop and on Election Day, which is the day by which the maximum number of people will be paying attention to the election. You know, these campaigns are still working hard and spending money and having big get-out-the-vote efforts, and they will through Monday to get people to the polls. And so when we have voter registration laws that mean you have to register 30 days before the election or 25 or 20 or 15, that really, I think, cheats citizens out of the opportunity to, you know, become engaged as election events and election activities might lead them to be engaged. Aside from that, on existing laws, we find that absentee voting is especially important for higher levels of turnout, that states that allow individuals to cast ballots absentee tend to have higher levels of turnout. Early voting is a little trickier. Much of the research suggests that while more people are voting in early voting, in the past, at least up and through 2008, some of that was actually not bringing new voters in, but having individuals who would have otherwise voted on Election Day simply cast their ballot at a different time. And so it will be interesting to see in this election whether that holds or whether early voting has become a time when individuals are responding to specific campaign events to show up. So I think those are the laws that get the most attention. There, of course, is a discussion on photo ID requirements. We did not study that in our book, and so we don't have too much to say about that other than to refer to most of the studies we observe suggests a bit of a negative effect depending on how campaigns respond and work with the photo ID requirements.
Jonathan Nagler?
I think in addition to the reforms just mentioned, one of the issues with early voting is how it gets implemented. And over the last 4 years, a lot of states have cut back on the number of days early voting is available and the number of places it's available. So if you move from a world where you've got 14 days of early voting and you have many places to do it, all of a sudden to a world where, well, we've only got 7 days for early voting, and by the way, we've got many fewer places open, it just makes it much harder to take advantage of that. That means fewer people use early voting, and that means when you get to Election Day, you have that, you know, the polling places become more crowded on Election Day. So what on the face of it seems like a sort of minor bureaucratic change. You're going to save some money by having fewer days of this, and you're going to have fewer places open. Is actually quite a nasty change in terms of the voting regime that the voters face, and all of a sudden it becomes much harder for people to vote. Anything that makes it harder for people to vote, we think, is going to have a negative effect on turnout. So states have implemented just quite a variety of changes that have really made it harder for Americans to vote rather than easier over the last 4 years or 8 years. And the question is, you know, do voters and parties work hard enough to overcome that it doesn't impact turnout negatively?
When voter turnout is impacted like that, is it usually a particular kind of voter that gets squeezed out, or is it sort of across the board, all types of voters? In other words, it's like the question that I think you and Jan had asked in an earlier research piece, which was, you know, is the vote representative whenever there are people squeezed out, or does it affect one group more than others?
So one of the things that we know is that election day registration, in particular as a reform, tends to help people who move a lot, and that means young people. So, you know, not making that available makes it that much harder for young people to vote. For the other reforms, the evidence is very mixed on exactly who is helped or hurt by different reforms. The one, ironically, that we did not study, photo ID requirements, all the data suggests that that hurts a set of people who are either very poor or, ironically, are very old. It tends to be poor people who don't have driver's licenses or other photo IDs, or old people don't tend to have those, very old people. There's, you know, pretty good data on who that is likely to hurt. For absentee voting and early voting, you know, changing those hours, it becomes a bit less clear as to exactly which groups are being hurt by that.
Well, thank you so much, Jan Lely, Jonathan Nagler, for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. It's a great joy to host you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Jan Lely is professor of political science at American University. She is co-author of Who Votes Now? Demographics, Issues, Inequality, and Turnout in the United States, Strength in Numbers, the Political Mobilization of Racial and Ethnic Minorities, and Mass Media and Politics, a Social Science Perspective. Jonathan Nagler is professor of politics at New York University. He is the director of the Politics Data Center and co-PI of the NYU Social Media and Political Participation Lab. He is co-author of Who Votes Now? Demographics, Issues, Inequality, and Turnout in the United States.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.